disco godfather.
Let's keep and greet the disco godfather.
Put your weight on it. All right, everybody out there, you got your mind on the wonder and your ass on the loose. Come on, get funky in here. Shoot the deuce to the blues. From the north to the south, from coast to coast, Godfather here's gonna give you the most. Put your weight on it. I'm the Godfather and my name is Tucker. Everybody knows that I'm a bad mother.
They hit the hit me. I want them alive.
Disco Godfather.
Got to get rid of everything. I'm a respected businessman in this community.
Hulk! Who sent you?
I'm rough and tough and don't take no stuff. Yes, this is the Godfather I'm talking to.
I want you to put a little slide in your glide and some soul in your soul and some dip in your hip. Some strut in your gut. Sit down, this is the place to be. If you need a little loving, you can call on me.
We're flying high on a disco trip. All across the baby USA. New York City, Frisco, too.
Miami, Memphis, Chicago,
and LA. Come on and dance. Let's dance. Come on and dance.
If you crave satisfaction, this is a place to find that action. Coming to this theater as its next attraction is the picture that will put you in traction. Disco Godfather, starring me, Rudy Ray Moore. Disco Godfather.
Neighbor, how long has it been since you had yourself a big hot screaming ear full of forgotten horrors? Well, that's too long. Pull in close now for a crepuscular half hour or so of the Forgotten Horrors Podcast with your hosts, John Woolley, Michael H. Price, and my own self, Wolf Brand Jack.
And thank you very much, Wolf Brand Jack, and my co-conspirator for this podcast, Michael H. Price. We've got Joey Hambrick at the controls, our producer. And we thought we'd talk this time about a Rudy Ray Moore film. Matter of fact, the last of the four narrative films that he made, the Dolomite films and then Petey Wheatstraw, and then he made this one, Disco Godfather, sometimes known as Avenging Disco Godfather. And that was the last one, except for Rude, his concert film in 82, that really starred him. I mean, he showed up as his Dolomite character in music videos and things. But this was kind of the last one, and it's a real departure. We're talking about, again, Disco Godfather from 1979 with Rudy Ray Moore. And one of the reasons we kind of took this tack is because of the new, at the time we're doing this, the new Eddie Murphy picture in which he plays Rudy Ray Moore.
Yeah, Dolomite Is My Name.
Dolomite Is My Name for Netflix. And have you seen that, Michael?
No, I have not had the chance to see it. I'm kind of holding out for the big screen, but the chances are slim.
Right, right. Well, Joey and I have seen it, and one of the great things about it is the whole stuff about the Dunbar Hotel, which I didn't know about. I loved Rudy Ray Moore's pictures, but I didn't know about the Dunbar Hotel and how they'd gone in and refurbished it and made it their headquarters for to make what amounted to the four films. And so there's a lot of that in there. There's not a lot of, you know, specific things. It's mostly about Dolomite and the persona that he adapted. But this is a completely, for those of you who know Rudy Ray Moore from the two Dolomite pictures, or even from Petey Wheatstraw, although this picture has something in common with Petey Wheatstraw, is in that it does not, it's not a specific genre exactly, because it just changes all of the time throughout the movie, just like Petey Wheatstraw does.
Yeah, it's kind of Rudy's answer to the Mod Squad, I think.
That's a good idea. Yeah, and it is, and we were talking about this before we went on, Michael, it's a very, Rudy Ray Moore, obviously, it's a message picture. Oh, and yeah. Rudy Ray obviously has something that he wants to do and say.
Rudy was a very righteous guy. I mean, he put on the tough guy, talk dirty personality, and he kind of presented a scary persona in his comedy.
Yes.
Very aggressive, not kind of friendly aggressive. And he had this way of subtly winking at the audience, both orally and visually. Mm-hmm. In the spoken word and in his pictures, where you kind of said, "Yeah, I'm just fooling with you." Mm-hmm. Rudy was he considered Disco Godfather a disappointment, and yet he brought something to it that he hadn't intended to bring to it, that made it much more story than a lot of his like rude and nasty self-celebration pictures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had wanted to make the title that he had intended was The Legend of Stagger Lee.
Yes.
And he didn't get his way because his investors, who appear to have been mafia connected, mm-hmm. said, no, let's do something trendy. Let's do something that'll sell. And of course, disco, as the Neville brothers said, was the thing today in 1979.
And The Godfather was also Godfather, the thing because Godfather. Of Francis Ford Coppola, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was right there on everybody's minds in Double Fords.
Mm-hmm.
So Rudy made the best of what he considered a bad situation. He considered the legendary bad black guy known as Stagger Lee to be the ancestor of his Dolomite character.
All right, that's fair enough. I could see that, yeah.
Most people in the general audience know Stagger Lee from the hit record by Lloyd Price,
mm-hmm.
which exists in two versions. One is a murder ballad, and the other one is a kind of a gambling feud with a make-nice ending.
And may I tell you, apropos of nothing, that the whitest version you will ever hear of Stagger Lee Ooh. Is done by Guy Lombardo's orchestra.
Ooh. Boy, and, I was going to guess Pat Boone.
No. Oh, this makes Pat Boone look funky. Mm, it is absolutely amazing. We have played it on my show. I do a show called The Hidden 60s Specials
over
KWGS in Tulsa. And we have played Stagger Lee, and it is stunning. So Anyway, go ahead, please. I didn't mean that was just, I didn't mean to get in there. Weeds were found.
We've got quite a collective history with Rudy Ray Moore. Tom Rinone, the art dealer and filmmaker in Texas, and I had, among our early mutual discoveries when we first started working together in the 80s, was that whatever happened to Rudy Ray Moore? Do you still got his record? Yeah, I still got his records. And we get into these pseudo-intellectual discourses about how he was easily the equivalent of Lenny Bruce.
Yes.
I think maybe an unwitting or inadvertent champion of the First Amendment, free speech and all that. Rudy got notorious. He got co-opted by Hugh Hefner, among other things. He also had a lot of trouble with the law over obscenity in his comedy routines on stage. And he ended up a bitter caricature of himself. Rudy addressed almost strictly a black audience, although there were a bunch of us white folks that picked up on his stuff right away.
Mm-hmm.
He was spontaneous. He was funny. He never stopped being funny. He didn't have the legal hassles, partly because of the racist law enforcement system that kind of ignores the black community except when there's trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Rudy was a very, very dedicated, you know, I mean, he was a comedian for all types. He had a G-rated church comedy routine that was just as funny as all get out. he could tone it down as he told Christina, my wife, and I backstage at one of his comeback engagements. He asked her if she'd found anything at all offensive in his first set, and she said, "Why, no, of course not. It's perfectly entertaining." She said, "Well," Rudy says, "Well, now, Ms. Lady, if anything in my routine should offend you in any way, I want you to tell me so I can come back and make it twice as nasty." he was a sweetheart. He was very professorial when he was out of character.
Now, this is about what time period that you book him down in Texas?
In the 80s, middle 80s, we discovered the mutual interest. And by the late or the waning 80s, talk and don't get it. Well, let's find that guy.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause
he had more or less vanished after Disco Godfather.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rude came out in 82, but that really didn't make much of a splash, did it?
That was not really much of a release, and Rude got a very sporadic mm-hmm. distribution. It finally, what kicked it up into a higher visibility was the reissue that was inspired by Eddie Murphy's concert film Raw.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy says, "Well, you think that's something? Wait till you see mine." And Tom and I found Rudy living in retirement and seclusion in Los Angeles. Got a telephone number, called up. He answered his own phone. No network of protectors. And once he had, you know, we were coming straight out of left field. He didn't know what to make of this approach. Once we had established our bona fides and asked him if he was amenable, he said, "Well," he said, "yeah, I got to be in Texas so-and-so coming up pretty soon to do my G-rated comedy routine for my mother's church," which is like, "Yeah, that's great." And he said, well, how about some of the real nightclub scene? And he says, "You show me a nightclub and I'll be there." And so we booked him into an authentic blues club in Dallas called Blues Alley, and into a very white bread college kids hang out in Fort Worth called The Hop, short for House of Pizza.
Mm.
And, you know, I had the newspaper connections going. We made the arrangements, got him flown in, and he showed up at The Hop that first night in Texas, and walks in, you know, grandfatherly looking fellow, white hair, carrying a walking stick, and looks around, steps to what passed for a backstage area, threw his stick in the corner, put on his Afro wig, and suddenly became Dolomite.
Wow.
It was great. He was great. I mean, it was like watching John Carradine inflate himself for a movie take.
Like we've talked about in Revenge, that I actually was on set and saw him do.
Yeah, and I saw him do the same thing when he was shooting that little cameo in Peggy Sue Got Married.
Right, right.
To watch the, you know, Rudy was not certain that this was the place to be or the occasion to be there, but he looked around, and one of the things that reassured him was he saw a bunch of his old time black fans sitting in the crowd.
Now, this is at the Hop?
The Hop. And that was the first time I'd ever seen more than one black individual at any one time in the Hop. And I mean, they were dressed up like for a night at the Guys and Dolls Club in 1975. And Rudy starts, I mean, he starts his routine before he goes on stage. He's like, I know you. And then he starts making with the friendly insults. Many of which shouldn't be repeated here.
Right, right, right.
And the audience just ate it up because they were used to his preemptive heckling.
Now, they have a crowd. They must have had kids that didn't know anything about Rudy Ray Moore.
College kids, but they had read about it in the paper.
Ah.
And they kind of knew what to expect. And, of course, Texas has always been a big soul music, R&B,
sure,
what have you, state.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was a lovely integrated audience. We had Tom's brother Pete Rinone playing drums behind Rudy. No band, just a very emphatic drummer. Pete's still in the drumming business. He works with Junior Brown now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Pete was there to do the rim shots and the fills and the bada bings. And he and Rudy just tore the place up.
And so you maintained contact with him until he passed?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. We stayed in touch. No sooner had he gotten that renewed shot of confidence than he started appearing on network television, small market network television, like the Arsenio Hall show. And I believe it was Arsenio Hall who dubbed him the godfather of rap, which is kind of a shallow designation, a narrow confining designation, but it was true, because not too many years before the comeback that Tom Rinone and I engineered, Rudy had been paid homage to by Two Live Crew, one of their proto rap records.
Right, right.
And then the interest starts building, and Big Daddy Kane had Rudy guest on one of his albums. They had a battle of insults in rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely stuff, you know, and
yeah,
it all stemmed from his reluctant retirement after Disco Godfather, leading up to the Whatever Happened to, Whatever Became Of, if you remember that series.
Sure, sure.
And then the tentative return that all of a sudden turns into a full-blown comeback. And the next thing you know, Rudy's talking about making some new movies. And he resurfaced more as an actor.
Yes, that's what I understand. Yeah, yeah. In videos as well as films, mostly.
And I believe some video games.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I've never followed that field too closely. But, you know, I mean, he was acting in low budget exploitation films, you know, goofy comedies, what have you, as late as 2009.
Now that's great. That's great. And now, of course, you know, posthumously, he's become a star again. I think this Eddie Murphy movie has really done some things for his memory. And it seems to me, and Joey, I think you'll agree, we've talked about this, seems pretty close to the spirit, if not the letter, of Rudy Ray Moore's life.
Oh, yeah. Fascinating stuff. Rudy told me the first night we met, getting ready for the Texas engagements, that Eddie Murphy had approached him during the Saturday Night Live period.
Yes.
And the early Hollywood days, and behaved in what Rudy described as a worshipful manner. Rudy did not flatter himself, but he was awed that a big time Hollywood star should consider him to be a major influence, because Rudy never was a major star. his pictures were major in a minor league. And he said Eddie had talked to him about maybe you could be in one of my movies. And described a role. And from Rudy's description, it sounds very like some of the characters or one of the characters in Murphy's film Coming to America, which of course happened without Rudy because Eddie Murphy decided to play all the parts in
Jamaica.
It's amazing to see the cycle of that career, because Rudy had had a frustrated period of trying to break out as a rock singer, rhythm and blues singer. There's a very good CD out collecting his vocal performances.
Well, there's a very good scene in the movie that Eddie Murphy does with Snoop Dogg, who is a DJ in a store, and Rudy Ray is at the very beginning of the picture is trying to get him to play his record. A department store is what I'm trying to say. Department store, yes. So so that part of it is, you know, it strikes me, you mentioned he was major in a minor way. It's a little bit like, you know, those guys, those legendary guys in the minor leagues who hit 70 home runs in a season and never make it to the majors, right? And or even, I suppose, in the Negro Leagues, it would have been the same thing, right? With Cool Papa Bell and people like that who didn't make it, like Minnie Minoso and like Jackie Robinson and Satchel Paige didn't make it to the majors. But you see that it's just a wing and a prayer. And that's the way Eddie Murphy, you know, they know nothing in the picture. You know, Rudy Ray Moore knows nothing about making films, just kind of this naked ambition, not unlike, say, Ed Wood in some ways.
Right. Very like that Ed Wood, that Al Adamson vibe, that whole,
thing
about it. Almost a DIY approach.
It is definitely a DIY approach. It's an outsider approach. And we should say in Disco Godfather, I think Joey would probably like for us about this point to talk about what the film's about. But after the first two Dolomite films, which are really just kind of just exercises in what Rudy Ray Moore thought that black audiences liked, and I guess he was probably right, Dolomite and Human Tornado, and then he makes Petey Wheatstraw, which has some horror elements in it, and then along comes Disco Godfather, which also has some horror elements in it, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, but it has horror elements in it in regard to or associated with drug addiction, and Rudy Ray plays an ex-cop who becomes a kind of a star of the discos, a star DJ, if you will, kind of a precursor to the whole hip-hop thing where you got your DJ and your MC. And his signature phrase is, put your weight on it.
Yeah.
Put your weight on it.
Little glide in your stride.
Put your weight on it at the very end of the film, of course, in the credits. Put your weight on it phrase by Rudy Ray Moore. So Rudy Ray's very proud of it. And he was proud of it because it's all over the place. Well, what happens is angel dust is affecting the community. And his own nephew gets whacked out on the whack, as they call angel dust, at some point. Inexplicably, they also call it Charmin. I'm not quite sure how that happens, but or why. But Rudy Ray then goes out to find the people who are destroying the community by supplying angel dust to all of these kids, and of course deals with drug kingpins and people in law enforcement who may not be what they're supposed to be.
Right.
There is some nightmarish stuff in it. There's also some disco. Lots of disco. There's roller disco. There's disco dancing. They're putting their weight on it throughout the entire picture. And it has a very downbeat ending. And it seems to me, and I don't know how much, I suspect a lot, when he was hamstrung with this, it's kind of like, you know, this may be the first time in the history of film commentary that Rudy Ray Moore and Val Lewton are mentioned in the same sentence, but it's that same deal with when RKO Pictures would give Val Lewton one of these goofy titles or a title that they thought was, was, you know, would bring people to box office, like I Walked with a Zombie.
Something lurid, yeah.
Yeah, or the Cat People or whatever. And it's the same thing. I think once he got the Cisco Godfather thing, I guess that he decided he would try and make a picture. He and his cohort would try and make a picture that would actually be a kind of a morality play.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is unlike what the first three pictures are, of course, in real life.
Those are, Rudy was never immoral, but he was often amoral.
He was often amoral, and Dolomite is a very amoral character. But the Disco Godfather is not an amoral character at all.
Yeah, he's closer to Rudy's actual indignant, friendly personality.
Is he? Good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to know that.
I think Rudy found himself in a situation that was contrary to his original wishes. I have no doubt with what the legend of Stagger Lee, if it had been made, would have been more of a Dolomite type picture.
Oh, it had to have been. Well, of course, then again, Petey Wheatstraw sort of pulls from that same sort of mythology, right, as Stagger Lee does.
Petey Wheatstraw is Dolomite's Paradise Lost.
Wow. Well, you know, I was worried about mentioning Val Lewton and Rudy Ray in the same. Now you're talking about Milton and Rudy Ray now.
Yeah, exactly. You know that blues, that famous blues singer, Blind John Milton.
That's right. Well, I do want to call attention to a couple of people behind the scenes in this. And one is our friend, and I know that you knew him as well, Robert Burns from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, yes, yes. What a wonderful guy he had to be, yes.
He was a terrific guy. I got to know him a little bit. As a matter of fact, one time when he was coming back from somewhere, I'd done a couple of stories on him for Fangoria, when I was working for Fangoria, and also for the Tulsa World. At the time, I believe he had done a video on genealogy.
Yes, he got very big into that.
Yes, he did. And he was coming back through on the turnpike, and he called me and said, I'm coming back through. Could we go have lunch? And great. And he was telling me Texas Chainsaw stories. He, I guess, was the set designer on Texas Chainsaw. I can't remember exactly what his title was.
Yes, indeed. He was a set dresser.
And he later on was he was a fine actor. He did that Confessions of a Serial Killer, which is still as creepy as anything you're ever going to want to see.
Which holds right up there with the Henry portrait of
And but they have very much the same feeling, very much the same, very disorienting feeling. Yeah. And he was, I really liked him. We did that Fangoria convention we did out in Plano, Texas. You and I did that together.
Definitely.
With Tony Timpone and the guys.
You bet.
And Bob was down there. Robert was down there as well, and signing his Confessions of a Serial Killer posters and stuff. And I always wanted to do a book on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I always thought that Bob would be such a good reference. And, of course, he took his own life after being diagnosed with terminal cancer, about 10 years ago now, right?
Loss.
Yeah, it was horrible loss.
Never was a brighter light in the art direction or filmmaking in general.
No, you're right. And in Disco Godfather, he's art director, and he also does special effects. And I'm telling you, the horror special effects come with the angel dust hallucinations.
Oh, yeah.
And and Rudy Ray's Disco Godfather's nephew, as the Disco Godfather says, "Where is Bucky, and what has he had?" And what he's had is angel dust, and he has these terrible sort of visions of witches and skeletons and these kind of Sugar Hill looking zombies. And then later on, Rudy Ray Moore himself, or the Disco Godfather himself, gets a snoot full of angel dust, and they do rotoscope. They do, and this is Burns, of course. They do rotoscope horror. They do all these crazy horror scenes that are just really, really creepy and outside the boundaries of what you'd expect to see.
That's pretty much, that's the caliber of effects that Roger Corman's film, The Trip, might have benefited from.
Exactly. Exactly. You're absolutely right. And it didn't. It was like I don't know if they were afraid to pull out the stops or just didn't know how to do it, but this is just the product of a incredibly creative mind, and Robert Burns, this is a great testament to Robert Burns. He couldn't have had very much money to work with, but whatever it was, he got it done. The other person in it that I'd like to mention is Ernie Fields Jr. Mm-hmm. Ernie Fields Jr. did the music. Now, Ernie Fields was one of our band. We had two, when I was at the Tulsa World, we had two classic old band directors, African-American band directors who had been around during the 1930s and 40s and had bands that toured. You know, we had, this was a very fertile place to tour because we were very close to Kansas City. There'd be, you know, they'd go up there and they'd work with Benny Moten's orchestra, and we had the Oklahoma City Blue Devils and all of that.
The territorial bands,
but Ernie Fields was a territorial band, and his son in the 1960s brought him, this is Ernie Fields Jr., brought him out to L.A., and put some studio musicians together, because that's what Ernie Fields was a studio musician and really knew the L.A.
Right.
scene. And still does. He's still around and knew the L.A. scene very well. Put together some studio musicians, and Ernie Fields, his dad, had a top 10 hit in 1961 with In the Mood, with a version mm-hmm. of In the Mood, and that was the Ernie Fields Orchestra. Well, this is Ernie Fields Jr. He's a hero in Tulsa, one of our Tulsa guys that we feel like really made good. And I was delighted to see his name in the credits. And he's on just about a writer, a co-writer of just about all of the songs that are in this picture. So it's and, you know, there's so many urban legends they get into. The one that really is disgusting is the one about cooking the baby.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we shouldn't be laughing. It's terrible. But the idea that this person gets on angel dust, the woman gets on angel dust, is it Thanksgiving, Joey? Is that what it is?
Uh-huh.
It's some banquet she's doing for her family, and she comes out, and they never, thankfully, I mean, Rudy Ray Moore had a attack of taste or something, and doesn't actually show a stuffed baby, but shows it from the back, and she's serving a baby to her family because she's Ooh. Whacked out on angel dust. Now, I have to tell you, when I was in the service in the early 1970s, one of the things, I was an enlisted man, and I was on a ship called the USS New Orleans, which was a helicopter carrier. And we were coming back from Vietnam. We stopped off at Hong Kong. And I was, among my duties, was I was the drug exemption representative, which meant that if somebody got caught, one of the people on the ship got caught doing drugs, they could come to me and I'd give some literature and basically say, don't do this until you get out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would always keep me apprised of what was going on. Well, apparently, a guy got in, or a rotor head, we call him, one of the airmen up there with the Marine Air Wing on the ship. They called me up. One of the medics came down from sick bay and called me up and said, Willie, come, I want you to come see this. So I go up to sick bay, and they've got a guy stretched out there with his eyes open. He's obviously catatonic. And they told me he'd taken, at the time, they were calling it animal tranquilizer, but it was PCP, which was angel dust. And they said, look at this. And they had a cotton ball. And they took that cotton ball, Michael, and they ran it across his open eye. Mm. And he never flinched.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the extent of what angel dust was doing to communities. But if Rudy Ray Moore experienced those sorts of things, I can see why he wanted to turn it into the kind of film that Disco Godfather was, which was a treatise against drug addiction.
Yeah, it's a cautionary film.
It is.
A morality fable, a very coarse morality fable, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, who's making this film anyway? It's Rudy's picture. Let him knock himself out. And I kind of begged to differ with him when he started griping about how he was forced to make Disco Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea that it wasn't necessarily his intention, but Rudy, you know, I mean, he took raw material that most filmmaking talents would reject out of hand throughout his brief motion picture career, and made stuff out of that lacking material that has become, an overused word, legendary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the material that Rudy Ray Moore impressed Eddie Murphy with before anybody knew who Eddie Murphy was. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see that appreciation come full circle.
And wouldn't you think that this is definitely, it's the last film. It didn't make money, as I understand it. No. But it is a departure for Rudy Ray Moore.
He had so much more to say. He was constantly inventing. The last time we visited in person, Rudy comes back to Texas, this time on his own. I mean, he took that momentum that Tom Rinone and I helped him build, and he just launched a new career. He could have lied about his age and passed for 10 or 20 years younger. Mm-hmm. He came back to Texas. He was doing the comedy club circuit called Hyenas.
Mm-hmm.
Had a date in Arlington, Texas. He calls me up at the newspaper office and never addressed me as Michael or Price or Mr. Price. He said, Michael Price, this is Rudy Ray Moore. And as you know, so I always called him King Rudolph the First, Second, and Third. And he says, I'm going to be so-and-so in the next few days. I want you to come out. I'm going to reserve you a front row seat. There's that professorial voice.
Yes.
And I want to see you occupying that seat in the front row. I am going to recite my famous poem, which he called Shine and the Great Titanic. It was an epic narrative poem about the sinking of the Titanic in 1912.
Right.
Of course, it was told in rhyming couplets, and many of them got quite rude. He said, "I have composed a version of this that has never been done in public, and I am going to recite it, especially for you." And it was like,
wow,
how can you refuse an invitation
Well, you can't refuse an invitation like that. How wonderful. And how was it
hilarious. It was he introduced a whole new character that hadn't been in the original rap Titanic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A character he called Rotatus. you remember Lead Belly's song about the Titanic?
Sure.
It was predicated on the championship boxer Jack Johnson,
mm-hmm,
trying to get onto the Titanic to go to England to fight and was denied passage because he was a black guy.
Right, right.
Taking that cue from Lead Belly, Rudy's version and some before it, I mean, he was coming from traditional rhyming songs of black rebellion.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he put the character he called Shine on the Titanic as the only black guy aboard. Well, he said, oh, that reminds me, there was another black guy on the Titanic, and his name was Rotatus. I should have had a recorder going. I don't know that he ever recorded that routine, but it was magnificent.
Rotatus.
He was the cook on the Titanic.
Ah, very good.
If you believe that version, well, you know, like we say in the Texas Folklore Society, all the versions are true if you know all the versions.
That's right. Well, I tell you, Vinegar Syndrome, I believe it is, Joey, is that right? Has got the new Disco Godfather out, or a new print of Disco Godfather out. Uh-huh. And it is absolutely beautiful, and it's really worth watching. And I always thought, I've seen all four of the Rudy Ray Moore pictures. I've always thought that was that Disco Godfather is the one that had a heart. They're all fun, but Disco Godfather has a heart, and I think Rudy Ray is trying to stretch his acting chops a little bit in it too.
Sure. He stretched them further. Even after that, even during that comeback period, when he was accepting acting parts in other films,
right,
and you could see him. What little I have seen of the new Eddie Murphy movie, it addresses that raw talent evolving into confidence.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, artistry is basically a matter of confidence anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although Ed Wood had lots of confidence.
Well, He committed his own brand of artistry.
He did. He did indeed. You're absolutely right. And that's a story for another time. We would like to mention that if you want to go online and look at either go on Amazon.com and look at Michael Price or me, John Woolley. And just we're doing this around the holiday season. And we would love for you to consider buying a book or two of ours. For they make dandy Christmas gifts for the person on your list who may be a little hard to buy for. I've got a couple of horror novels out now that are getting really good reviews. We've got Satan Swine and is the second one in the series, in our cleansing series, the first one being Seventh Sense. Michael, which you have helped us so much with flap copy on. We appreciate that. And we've just got a lot of stuff out there. And we would, if you would like to support this podcast, support us, we would be delighted if you take a look at it and just and consider perhaps going that way with a Christmas purchase or two. And what's the latest thing that someone could buy of yours, Michael?
Well, the latest thing is the new Western Swing Masters album called Santa Claus Blues. And you got to put a Y on that Santa Claus.
Of course you do. Yes.
it's actually kind of a cherry picked collection from my previous, from my Christmas albums from several years back.
Mm-hmm.
Some remixes, new material in a new context and gussied up with some of the old familiar material that, I fancied myself making blues albums for years. Heck, I was subconsciously playing Western Swing.
Well, you know, blues and Western Swing are pretty doggone close when you get right down to it.
You betcha.
And I'll tell you, I have been playing one of your Christmas songs for I don't know how long with the Christmas edition of Swing on This, which is my radio show on publicradiotulsa.com. You can get it anywhere. I say publicradiotulsa.org, not .com.
Yes,
you can get it anywhere streaming 7 p.m. Tulsa time every Saturday night. It's a Western Swing program, and you have helped my playlist because I've been playing songs from Swing on This, the disc that you titled from my show. I'm honored that you did that, and also from Swing Swang Swung, which is the second one. Grits, you've done some great work on that. I'm glad to be able to be playing that on the show.
Mighty glad.
Now, we haven't talked about this, but next time around, there's a film that I would like to talk about.
Yeah.
And it is called Fingerprints.
Mm.
And it was made in Oklahoma by Gray Fredrickson, who, you know, has an Oscar for, I believe the Oscar's for Godfather 2 as the producer. Mm-hmm. And he also was a producer on Apocalypse Now and several other things on UHF. And he made a series of films in Oklahoma that I was privileged to be on the set for some of them. And I think Fingerprints is a really overlooked, good little ghost story that I'd like for us to deal with next time, if that's all right with you.
Lovely. What's the year of that
one? 99 maybe. I'm not quite sure. I'll find that out. But it was direct to video. And I'm not sure if it's got Armand DeSante in it or not. Armand DeSante came down and did a couple of pictures with Gray Fredrickson, and as I say, I was on the set for a couple of them down in Oklahoma City, and I really think this picture is the best of the bunch, and I'd like to maybe bring it to folks' attention.
Always delighted to find something new.
We are indeed. We want to thank everybody also for listening to this podcast and again, taking a look at the books that we have for sale, Michael and I, and we just appreciate it. We've got the Forgotten Horrors Facebook page that Joey, you take care of that, don't you?
Absolutely.
Somebody does. It must be you. Just by process of elimination, it's not Michael or me. Got to be you. And we have the Facebook page, Forgotten Horrors. Forgotten Horrors podcasts are free to get on the Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got the name, which this happens sometimes for us. You've got a film that you'd like for us to talk about that you'd like to see maybe break in a little bit more, break out of being a forgotten horror and be slightly less forgotten. We're the guys to do it.
That's the one.
Thank you so much, pal. We'll be talking to you soon.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks, everybody.